Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Greg Scommell, leading white shark expert in the Atlantic, senior fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, and currently directs the Massachusetts Shark Research Program. And we're talking about his book, Chasing Shadows, My Life Tracking the Great White Shark. Greg, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here, Mark.
Now, right off the top, I want to say we're going to use the term white sharks, not great white sharks. Can you explain why?
Well, you know what? A lot of people still use the term great white sharks, and that is absolutely fine. Many years ago, the scientific community, just to simplify common names, they do this every 10 years for all species of fish. And one particular decade, they decided, okay, might as well just drop the great. We'll simplify it and call it white shark. It's the same species as the great white shark. It's just that most scientists simply refer to it as the white shark.
This book is amazing because it really is a memoir of your life and how you got interested in sharks and ichthyology. And also a lot of information of what we've learned just in the last couple of decades about white sharks. But it begins in incredibly dramatic fashion. I mean, I have to say this book begins cinematically. You're on a whale and shark trip out of Plymouth, September 2008. And all these people are on the boat, really excited actually to see sharks, maybe not necessarily whales. And then there's a shark attack in Newcomb Hollow. What an amazing way to begin the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, throughout this conversation, you're going to hear me reference, you know, Rhett Talbot, who is my co-author on this. And, you know, he's a brilliant writer. And, you know, the way he outlined this book, and we wrote it together, but, you know, he's a testament to, you know, how a scientist can partner with a real writer and make a great story. And so, you know, kicking it off with the reality of white sharks is really what we did in this book. You know, one thing I've never done is tried to bury my head in the sand when it comes to this species. I fully acknowledge and come to grips with and have to deal with, you know, the fact that every now and then they bite people and in some cases kill them. So that's the harsh reality. And the book opens with that.
And it actually finishes with the challenge that you face all the time, because you're a shark biologist, you're an ichthyologist, but you also consider yourself a public ambassador for white sharks. And there's always that tension that exists between the public perception of the shark and the biological interest in the shark.
Absolutely true. You know, and it happens in my own internally with me as well. You know, there's always the emotional side of me that reveres these animals, and the scientist side of me that, you know, must be extremely objective, and sometimes they're at odds. And the similar thing happens with the public. And I think it's getting better. It's certainly better than it was 50 years ago. But you know, again, I'm up against that. And I find myself right in the middle all the time, you know. Having to deal with that. And I, in many ways, I like it, and other ways I don't. You know, it's a challenge, and I like challenges, as you will see in the book.
Now, in 1972, it was the Marine Mammal Protection Act. That was important for the gray seal population in Massachusetts and in New England. They just made a huge comeback after that. And in 1997, there was a ban on killing white sharks, and that had an effect on shark population, and it should be obvious to most people, but could you just explain it quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was instrumental in allowing many populations of marine mammals, including seals, and specifically on Cape Cod, the gray seal population. Now, it took 50 years for it to come back, and we're not even sure what it should be. But in response to that, you know, you basically have opened what amounts to a new restaurant on the Outer Cape. And that's going to draw customers. And those customers, you know, are known as the men in the gray suits, right? Those are the white sharks. This is the job of the white shark, to go out, and eat seals. And if you're going to open a new restaurant area that white shark that overlaps with white shark distribution, which is the case, those sharks are going to shift their presence from offshore feeding to going to the new restaurant. And that's exactly what's happening right now. So, but in the time that white sharks and seals were not in that area, you know, tourism exploded on Cape Cod over the last 100 years. And as a result, you know, this natural predator-prey relationship, which occurs right along the shoreline, overlaps with human activities. And that's where we get the potential for disaster in some cases.
Now, for people who don't know, and you should know, but if you don't happen to know, there are two common seal species in Massachusetts. And I think the one everybody's thinking about is the cute little harbor seal. The gray seal is a big mother seal. <That's>...
It is. It'll get over 800 pounds.
Like, wow.
It has the head of a horse.
I know.
They call them horsehead seals, as you know.
That was the old name for them was horseheads.
Yeah, horseheads. And they're big, and they're viable prey for white sharks. They're challenging prey for white sharks. But, you know, there's this dichotomy has grown up. You know, the polarization of Cape Cod is occurring because there are many who love the seals and think of it as the restoration of a natural ecosystem, which in many ways it is. And there are those who hate the seals because they're competing with the seals on many levels, whether it be fishing or, you know, for space along the shoreline or water quality. And so you get this this polarization of the Cape that has occurred. And there are sides that people jump on when it comes to the seals. And my argument is always, you know, okay, let's all take a breath and let the sharks do their job.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, I got to talk to you about your long history with getting interested in sharks, which is outlined wonderfully in this book. The first shark you saw was on television, 1968. You're 6 years old, and you see the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, narrated by Rod Serling.
Yeah. Fascinating to me. I mean, I think to the world in terms of just what Jacques Cousteau brought into our living rooms back then.
I mean, I know.
We take for granted the camera systems that exist today, the underwater, you know, breathing systems we have, you know, and he was a pioneer, you know. So to bring the world into the ocean was fascinating to me, you know, to see, but also to see sharks on television in their natural environment, you know, because in all too many cases, you know, the books that we had back then had sharks dead on the dock.
That's right. That's right.
Underwater photography was primitive at best. And here I was seeing it. And I really did become infatuated with not only the underwater world and, of course, Jacques Cousteau, but also the animals that he was showing us, and specifically sharks.
I love your writing about the movie Jaws. You were, I think, a high school freshman, 1975. You saw Jaws, and I can totally identify with this. You became enamored by the character Matt Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
You wanted to be that biologist.
I thought he had the coolest job on earth.
He did, and he was the coolest character in the whole movie.
He really was. You know, from the very beginning. You know, when he shows up, you know, in Amity, to, you know, there's one specific scene, and, you know, there's the dissection scene. I love the necropsy on the shark. That's phenomenal. But I also love when he's on his boat and it's at night and he's got the Chief Brody with him and they're looking for, you know, the shark or Ben Gardner's boat or whatever. They're out and about, you know, investigating. And he's got all the gadgets that were the latest technology at the time, which are at best primitive now. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy has got it dialed in. You know, what a job. And he throws on his scuba gear. He goes in the water. And, of course, the famous scene of Ben Gardner's head floating out of the hull of the boat scared the living heck out of all of us. But I thought this guy had it. This is it. I got to do this. Can I do this? Is that a job? Is this a real job? Because mom, dad, you know, we're living in Southern Connecticut. I want to do this. Oh, sure, Greg, whatever. It sounds good. Go ahead.
And now you are.
And now I am, you know. So I, you know, the cliche, you pinch yourself, you know, and I do that all the time saying, wait a minute, you know, just when I'm feeling tired at the end of a day or end of a season when I'm really burned out from the field work and from the media and the juggling, you know, I say to myself, but wait a minute, you're doing the dream job. You're doing everything you've always wanted to do. So take a breath, Greg, and
that's
relax.
Right.
And realize what you've got.
What's amazing about Jaws, and this is, you write about this in the book, is Peter Benchley's sort of 180 that occurred, where he actually really regretted causing the anti-shark frenzy.
Yeah. I guess we call it the Jaws effect, and I think Peter was a bit too harsh on himself. You know, absolutely, he scared the living daylights out of, you know, the world, you know. And it was really, you know, it was really Spielberg, right?
That's right.
And Peter's book was wonderfully written, and it's a great, you know, and he'll admit it was a horror story, you know, and that's what it was. It's a horror movie and one of the best of all time. But people walked away from it thinking it was reality. And I think what I hope my book does is also sets the record straight.
Yep.
Relative to Jaws. But Peter Benchley had nothing to do with the explosion in commercial shark fishing that happened in the 80s and 90s that really led to the demise of shark populations in the U.S. and beyond.
I know.
Commercial fishermen weren't going out and killing sharks because they didn't like them. They killed them because they were worth money. And whenever you start a market on any animal, any creature, you know, it's going to lead to, you know, massive exploitation rates. And that's exactly what happened. So in many ways, I think Peter's was a bit too harsh on himself. But I understand how he felt. And, you know, certainly, you know, scaring people, you know, which we do now all the time with Hollywood does it.
Constantly. Oh, yeah.
You know,
Megalodon, the Meg.
Yeah, the Meg, you know, Sharknado, of course, which I find very entertaining. You know, Deep Blue Sea, you name it. There's all kinds of shark horror movies still, you know, because it's one of those great demons that people like to, you know, are drawn to, you know, dinosaurs and sharks.
Now, you give a lot of credit continually throughout the book for the people who influenced and taught you as you went through graduate school. And I want to mention three names, and if you could just briefly talk about their importance. I think it's Jack Casey, Wes Pratt, and Chuck Stillwell.
Yeah.
Three people that seem to be really key to your education and to your field work, and also turning you into the person you are today.
Yeah, that's spot on correct. You know, all three of those guys, you know, Wes and Chuck worked for Jack Casey at the Cooperative Shark Tagging Program, which was started in 1963, and, you know, in Sandy Hook, New Jersey. It was moved up to Narragansett, Rhode Island, and conveniently for me, not far from URI, where I was going to school, in the Bay Campus, right across the street of URI. So, to make a long story short, I started volunteering at that program, and they brought me on as a technician when a slot opened, And that in and of itself is a great lesson to kids. Don't be afraid to volunteer to do what you love to do. Yeah. And just working with all three of those guys and watching, you know, their field techniques, in addition to how they learned themselves, how they conducted research, and actually be in the field with them, whether it be sampling at tournaments or on research cruises, and just hanging out socially. It was amazing to me. So I just saw Jack Casey about a week and a half ago. He's 90 years old.
Wow.
I spent the day with him. We're making a documentary about white sharks, and it was a pleasure to be with him again. And he's amazing. I mean, the way he taught me how to leverage filmmaking to get research done, how to work with commercial and recreational fishermen to learn from them and get research done. And Wes taught me how to be, you know, a good underwater photographer, how to do excellent lab work, how to work in the field, how to dissect a shark, you know. And Chuck was, taught me how to be at sea, you know. And these guys were my mentors, and to this day, I can't say enough about what the gifts they gave me, the tools they put in my toolbox to make what I am today.
What I also love about your book is that you really share the real joy of doing field work.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I'm a classically trained fisheries biologist, which means, you know, as Jack Casey used to call it, we did a lot of nuts and guts. You know, we went out there and, you know, we dissected shark, we sampled shark, we tagged sharks. We were on research boats. We spent weeks and weeks at sea. You know, each one of those is an amazing adventure. It's a great joy to me. I mean, I still love going in the field at my age and plan to do so in a couple of days when the weather settles out. So, yeah, I love the field aspect of it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Greg Skomel, leading white shark expert in the Atlantic, senior fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, and currently directs the Massachusetts Shark Research Program. We're talking about his book, one of the great books about science and how science gets done and how you learn to get involved, Chasing Shadows, My Life Tracking the Great White Shark. Now, Greg, there's so many interesting parts of your book, but one of the things is you trace the public's attitude towards sharks. And originally, the feeling about catching sharks, and the quote is in your book, it was like collecting garbage. that people just basically, there was no use for sharks.
So that's exactly right. You know, the general feeling is that most recreational big game fishermen targeted tunas, marlin, swordfish. Those were the species that they absolutely wanted. You know, they were good eating, they were incredible game fish, and sharks were considered kind of the scourge of the ocean. You know, it was like, if you went shark fishing, you were certainly, you know, not somebody that was targeting a real game fish. And this persisted through, you know, at least half of the 20th century. And it really wasn't until some of those other species started declining. Or when there was perhaps a shark bite or shark attack, that fishermen would go out and initially just go to remove sharks. Oh, let's go shark fishing and kill as many as we can because they hurt people and they're garbage fish. And then, you know, it slowly began to evolve in the late 60s into more of a recreational fishery. Because tunas were declining, swordfish were declining. The marlins were tough to find. You had to go out really far to find these fish. And tournaments were starting to grow as a competitive event to go out and see who can catch the biggest shark. And at first, it was a dual purpose. Well, we'll go out, we'll win money, we'll have a great competition, and we'll also rid the ocean of these horrible animals. But slowly, it evolved, you know, through the 80s, 90s, early 2000s into more competitive fishing events. And, you know, we used to go to every tournament we could.
Well, you took advantage of the tournaments as a way to collect data.
Yeah. And, you know, as long as the tournaments were run legally under U.S. and local fishing regulations, then sustainability, you know, was being met. And we felt that if you're going to bring in a dead shark and the fishermen are going to let you sample it, take various tissues to study its natural history, why not do that? And that was Jack Casey's model, you know, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And those of us who worked under him saw it as a really viable method to learn about these species to ultimately conserve them. Of course, it got very contested in later years as people began to turn against shark tournaments. And I understand it. But, you know, I would absolutely say that thousands of research papers about the biology of these animals came out from tournament sampling over the years. And many of those are now used to save populations.
Well, as you pointed out before, and also in the book, it's actually the commercial shark fishing that's the biggest danger to shark populations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when shark fisheries exploded in the 80s, they were largely driven by growing demand for shark fins in the Asian trade, so Asian markets, and shark fins became a hot commodity. And that's where the whole concept of finning came up and started on a global scale. And shark populations became decimated very, very quickly. The U.S., you know, had to play catch up when it came to shark fisheries and shutting them down. And I think we've done a great job over the last 40 years in doing that. But it's been a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice by fishermen to make that happen. But shark populations, at least in the U.S., are now coming back. But it was really the commercial exploitation of sharks that led to their demise.
One of the fascinating things about this whole history of these shark tournaments, though, is that, yeah, the biologists would do the sort of dockside dissections and take samples of everything from parasites to whatever. But you still didn't know a lot about the behavior of the sharks until you started tagging them. And so this sort of these tournaments also became sort of a volunteer tagging program, too.
You know, exactly. And that's the program that Jack, you know, really spearheaded, you know, in the early 60s. And it still goes on today. And basically, the only tags available to us back then
were these
conventional tags. And they're really just little markers. You know, you put a marker on a shark, you catch it, you release it, you put a marker on it, you mark down where, when it was caught, what species, the size of it. And then someday somebody's going to catch it again, maybe. You know, usually on average about 5 out of 100 are recaptured. And then, you know, you get a second data point. And if you do that to thousands of sharks, and this is what Jack did, you know, working with commercial and recreational fishermen, a lot of fishermen at tournaments did this, you know. That's how we started to learn about the migratory behavior of many species. And I think the most notable being the blue shark, which demonstrated after thousands of recaptures that the blue shark migrates throughout the entire North Atlantic Ocean. So those early tags were pretty instrumental in starting to open our eyes to the movements of these animals. But it was the newly sophisticated tags that I really embraced in later years.
Now, I don't want to run out of time before, at the end of the book, you have a lot of mitigation strategies for helping to prevent shark attacks. And I want to make sure we talk about those because they seem like common sense things. First of all, the important thing is there's no silver bullet.
That's exactly right. You know, I think that we live in an age where people want a fast solution to a problem, to any issue, right? And that's just the way society, I think, has become, you know, and it's just not possible when it comes to mitigating for shark attack, you know. The important thing we try to emphasize is, first of all, the rarity of it. But even though they are far more rare than, you know, dog attacks, you know, people still, it only takes one, you know, to impact them, the psyche of humans.
But I just want to mention these. First of all, better shark spotting. You suggest the lifeguard towers be a little bit higher, so that you could they wear polarized glasses so that they can spot the sharks out there. And many of these sharks are tagged now with modern tagging, so smart buoys and drones could pick these sharks up.
Yeah, there's all kinds of techniques out there. The important thing to emphasize is not a single one of them is 100% effective.
That's right.
All of them.
But it does definitely decrease the chances.
Yeah. To me, it's all about information. And many of the town managers on the Cape get this. You know, the public safety officials get this. The more information they have to make decisions, the better they're going to be at managing and enhancing public safety. And so, you know, we use buoy systems that will detect our tagged sharks. You know, we're evaluating the use of drones, you know, like you said, educating lifeguards, getting them up on stands, polarized lenses, know what your beach topography looks like at low tide
That's
versus
right.
high tide. And most importantly, educate the public. You know, when you walk on that beach, you're going to see a sign that's a picture of a white shark, and it says white sharks feed here, basically. So be aware of that. Everybody going to those beaches needs to know that when you go in the water, you are overlapping with a predator that's feeding on its natural prey. And we think education is critical. And I think, you know, as I highlight extensively in the book, our work with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy really helps do that.
Also, stop the bleed classes. And people might not understand this, but when a shark bites you, especially a large predator like a white, you can bleed out pretty fast if people don't understand how to apply a tourniquet correctly.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first steps that the towns took with funding from the Conservancy and from the state was to enhance communication and medical, the ability of medical professionals to get there, and training, you know, stop the bleed classes, you know, get the, you know, it, these sharks, as you noted, Mark, you know, do extensive damage, but you can save lives if you can get medical attention to them. So enhancing communication, you know, some of these beaches don't have cell service. So getting that service out there, you know, getting medical professionals to the scene and stopping the bleed, you know, will saves lives, you know, and that's a critical first step. You know, you're not going to be able to prevent every shark bite because there's always going to be somebody that's surfing or boogie boarding or swimming out deep. It's going to happen rarely, you know, maybe once every few years, but it's going to, it could happen, and you need to be able to respond to it.
Now, there's so much shark biology that's in this book too, and we have barely touched on that. How far north do whites go?
White sharks will go as far north as Newfoundland.
Wow.
So, yeah, and that's historical. That's not new. A lot of people think, well, climate change is driving white sharks north. That's not true. We have records going back to 1800 that show that white sharks go as far north as Canada and routinely do so.
And sharks are unlike any other fish, and they're slow breeders. I mean, they only have a few young, they're unlike other fish.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things we do in the book, and you notice, I'm sure, is, you know, we talk about the biology of the white shark, not like like a textbook would, but through the eyes of the shark.
I know. You know, you follow the shark, like individual sharks, up their journey up the coast.
Yeah, from when they're born right up to when they're adults.
We're going to have to end here. We're out of time, unfortunately.
I'm sorry,
too, because I could talk to you for another hour. My guest tonight is Dr. Greg Scommel, leading white shark expert in the Atlantic, senior fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, and currently directs the Massachusetts Shark Research Program. And we've been talking about his book, which has got all sorts of information in it, Chasing Shadows: My Life Tracking the Great White Shark. Greg, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I've loved every minute of it. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.